Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who has literally been working on intelligence as well as bringing a considerable amount of it to bear for our country. In terms of border security is our first guest. His name is Todd Bensman. He is the National Security Fellow for the Indispensable Center for Immigration Studies and the author of an important new book, America's Covert Border War, which talks about jihadists trying to get into our country and efforts to prevent it. He is also the author of an important new report at the Investigative Project on Terrorism about the topic that we're going to turn to first with him. It is to be found at investigativeproject.org, and I commend it to you. Todd Bensman, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's good to have you with us.
So CBP put out a press release on April 5th that disclosed two Yemenis were apprehended in the Calexico, California area after crossing the border, and both of them were on the FBI's terrorism watch list. One of the Yemenis was caught on January 29th, and the other one was caught on March 27th. And one of these two Yemenis also was on the no-fly list, which is a, a much higher bar of danger to get on that list. It's an exclusive list of particularly dangerous jihadists. CBP very quickly took down this press release. I asked why, and I did get an explanation that they had included information that hadn't been properly reviewed. They had disclosed information that they hadn't properly reviewed. And one piece of that information might be the fact that hidden in the insole of his shoe, a cell phone SIM card, which is not something that your typical immigrant over the border looking for a new life in America would do. So what this really does show is that, you know, terrorist suspects, jihadist suspects can and do cross that border. These are hardly rare cases. It happens all year long, every year. People like this cross the border. It's a good thing that they caught these guys. It shows that the system is working at the moment.
But we are uncertain as to how many have gotten away.
That's right. You never know what you don't know. Folks like this, you know, could evade Border Patrol and get into the interior and sort of disappear. Or they could just simply claim they may not be on a watch list. Not everybody from Yemen is on a watch list. And we have a lot of Yemenis coming in right now because of the civil war. And the civil war has drawn in terrorist organizations on the Shia and Sunni spectrum, both sides. Everybody's over there right now fighting. And you just don't know who's who over there and which Yemenis might come over the border. And it's not like you can call the Yemeni government and ask for an intel feed.
So let's just tease this out a little bit, Todd Bensman. A guy comes in with a SIM card in his shoe. Presumably, U.S. intelligence is reviewing the data on that SIM card for phone numbers and contact information and others that may well be networked with this individual, perhaps people that he was supposed to work with once he got inside the United States. Presumably, that's why they were now reviewing the information that had been released. But everybody's been tipped off that if you're on that SIM card, you're well advised to be on a burner phone or otherwise laying low. But your point is really that we are under assault from people who wish to come here to do us harm. And while the Customs and Border Patrol were successful in intercepting these guys, there's a lot of reporting, including by you, my friend, that their eyes are on the other ball at the moment. They're being reduced to being nannies for large numbers of children, for example, or somehow shepherding individuals who come across the border into buses and into the interior of the country. They're not, as many of them certainly, doing the mission we rely on them to do as are needed. Talk about that in the context of your research and writing on, you know, this jihadist and other threats that we're facing from the border.
Well, yeah, of course. We are in the midst of an escalating crisis of illegal immigration and border entries, mostly by Spanish-speaking people, not Arabic speakers. And also, what that does is it distracts mightily from attention that needs to be paid continuously to people like these Yemenis that are crossing. We have had 171,000 apprehensions or encounters at the border in just the month of March. My guess is it'll probably be, you know, close to 250,000 this month and higher the next month. We are overwhelmed. Our systems are crashing. And when that happens, you can't guarantee that you're going to ever catch people like the Yemenis. I'm glad that we caught them. I know the California border is a little slower right now than the Texas border. Yemenis cross the Texas border all the time, too.
Yeah, but it's not Yemenis alone. It's Iranians, it's Iraqis, it's Syrians, it's, you know, people from all over the world, literally. But this is apparently prompted in part a comment that the Washington Times picked up on yesterday, Todd Bensman, that indicates that the Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, Alejandro Mayorkas, is apparently having second thoughts about one of Joe Biden's first actions, which was to suspend the construction of the wall. What do we know about what's going on with that, and will it make a difference, do you think?
Well, the suspension of all construction without thought on Trump's border wall was inane. Left these ridiculous looking gaps. You can see it from helicopters. You can see it from drones. You can see it on the ground. I call them Biden border wall gaps. It's ridiculous. They're smuggling corridors, and they're contemplating filling some of the shorter gaps. I guess it's unclear whether they're going to fill some of the larger ones. There are some that are a mile or two miles wide. I hope they fill those too. My feeling on this is that is campaign ad footage for the Republicans in 2022 and in 24 as well. And I'm guessing that border security is not chief in mind for closing those gaps. I think that's a campaign.
It's a political calculation.
Messaging situation there. So that's just my personal opinion, but I'm glad that they'll close them if they actually wind up doing that, because it's just stupid. I've been on the ground. I see those. They're wide open for smugglers, and they use them. They're using them. Human smuggling and drug smuggling.
Todd, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you for your time today, my friend. The great work you do at the Center for Immigration Studies, and for joining us today. We'll talk with you again soon. Next up, we will speak with Dan Celia about financial crises we're facing here in America and beyond.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back and joined once again, I'm very pleased to say, by a man I admire greatly and have the privilege of collaborating with on his own extraordinary programming, Financial Issues, on some 600 radio stations and television programs across the country. His name is Dan Celia. His ministry is called Financial Issues Stewardship Ministries, and he brings a wealth of experience in the capital markets as well as in communications to bear on behalf of all of us. And we're always pleased that he shares some of those insights with us here at Secure Freedom Radio as well. Dan, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
It's great to be back, Frank. Thank you for having me.
Well, I know you've got on your mind some of the same things that I do, Dan, and I'm always interested in getting your insights into them. Specifically, we're watching play out some dramatic public policy changes that are being brought about by the Biden-Harris administration. Some of them have to do with, domestic policy initiatives like infrastructure investment and otherwise sort of trying to shift the trajectory of our country really from a free market capitalist system to one that is much more centrally controlled. I think one of the big beneficiaries of this is likely to be the Chinese Communist Party, not the American people for sure. Give us your thoughts on all of that and how it's playing out as you see it.
Yeah, well, I think it's playing out and I speak just purely as an economist and from an economic perspective, but we're playing right into China's hand. And, you know, we have an enormous amount, in my opinion, my thoughts are we have a political chaos in this country right now, almost on every level, on the county level, state level, national level. I mean, there seems to be this chaos everywhere. And it is mostly involving an enormous amount of your rational thinking, particularly as it comes to economic matters. Now, China doesn't care much about anything but economic matters and military might and dominance, obviously. And we are, as they watch this, China, that is, watches the chaos unfold politically, understanding that with each passing day, we seem to get weaker and weaker. And yet on the strength that we were standing on just a few short months ago, all but gone, if nothing else, diminished greatly. And we continue to see that. And communist China has to be, you know, they're winning a war through our own self-inflicted chaos. That they're never going to need to fire a shot. They're not going to need to do that because of things like taking away the limits on unions to organize. You know, that's going to continue to hurt our manufacturing sector. It is great for China because it pushes companies out of here once again.
Capital gains, tax increases, and all the rest, too.
Yep, income tax. For corporate America, at the very same time, you've got Biden thinking that this is irrelevant to growth. And I can't help but wonder, could they be that stupid? I mean, could politicians be that stupid to think that it really is going to help a free market economy?
Well, I'm not sure they're interested in a free market economy. Dan, do you think? I mean, it certainly seems more and more centrally planned economics is what they have in mind for us. And to your point, Dan, we watch with horror, I think many of us, the degree to which the Chinese communists seem to have been not only encouraging, but actually enabling the election of Joe Biden. And the kind of outcome that you're talking about might not have been an accident, comrade, as the communists are fond of saying. But to this larger point, Dan, qui bono, as they say, the Chinese are certainly positioned to benefit from political chaos internally. And it might get a lot worse, might it not, if this Derek Chauvin case proves not to be the slam dunk conviction that the prosecutors have in mind. But we watch, you know, some of the folks who brought us the pandemonium in the streets of America taking to them once again across this country, Black Lives Matter, Antifa, the like.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and you're exactly right, Frank, when we think of all these things and it is becoming a centralized economy. That's what they want. They want an economy that is obviously that's what Americans want. That's what the American politicians want. And there's issues on both sides of the aisle because we have such an economically inept Congress. But, you know, the Chinese economy is projected to do 8.4% this year. So just think for a moment, if we continue on the path that we are going, it is very likely that if they have an 8% growth in their economy, it's going to feel or look more like a 12% economy on the world stage of economic standing, so to speak, for the Chinese government. This idea of Biden being in power is the greatest thing that has ever happened to the communist regime. And we continue to make ourselves weaker and weaker and weaker on every front, whether it be our south border, whether it be international affairs, whether it means the G8 or 7 or 6 or whatever it's going to be with an alternative currency in order to help out through this pandemic, which is a wonderful wrapper that they're trying to wrap all this in. I mean, it is crazy, and it's all self-inflicted, and all of this is accelerating the spiral downward.
Well, I think I would argue that some of it may be inflicted by this outside force too, but Dan, to your point about the international currency, our colleague Kevin Freeman has been on this program warning about this for years now, and I know you've been focused on it too. If we wind up printing more money to pay for at least what's ostensibly an infrastructure bill, $2.3 trillion more, is it not likely that this will prove the proverbial straw breaking the camel's back with those in China, yes, but also elsewhere around the world, Russia and, you know, South Africa and Brazil and the like have been pushing for years now to have an alternative currency. Perhaps it's a Chinese-issued cryptocurrency, perhaps it's something else, but an alternative currency to the dollar as the reserve of the world. And what would the implications of that be, should it eventuate?
Well, it could mean bankruptcy for the United States of America, the absolute, the credit rating dropping dramatically. I mean, we have to remember, right, higher interest rates. And right now we're organically having higher interest rates because we're having inflation. We're having inflation at the very same time we're seeing irrational market growth. That's going to lead to more inflation. So, and now you've got this debt issue. And keep in mind that somebody's got to buy this debt. We don't have a gold standard, right? So we have to monetize it somehow. And we monetize it by selling it. We sell our debt. Once it's sold, then we have value placed on it and we put it in circulation, so to speak, and we haven't monetized. Who's going to buy this debt? Well, who's buying the debt is the Federal Reserve. So
how does that work, Dan? I'm sorry, just one more point for the layman. How exactly does the Federal Reserve buy our debt?
Well, so the Federal Reserve has about $12 trillion of our debt by my figures. They would say 6 or 7, but they have $12 trillion of our debt. They buy it so that it can be monetized and we don't have to depend on China or Japan or someone else buying it because, you know, China is no longer our largest debt holder. It is the Federal Reserve. Now, in the Federal Reserve's case, it is nothing more than a balance sheet transaction. It's really not anything that is happening. But the notion.
But is it fair to say it's printing money effectively?
Well, no, not the Federal Reserve. No. The Treasury is printing all the money they want, and of course they stare at all this money and say, all right, how are we going to put this in the system? And the Federal Reserve says, well, we'll have to buy it. We're going to have to buy it. So the Federal Reserve, being a quasi-private institution, is saying we're going to buy the debt. We're going to put it on our book. So therefore, it's going to lend value to it, and it's going to be monetized. Just like we would not print money if we didn't have the gold to back it up, we now can't print money unless we know we have buyers for that debt. So here's the two scenarios. The Federal Reserve goes bankrupt because of their debt, or the United States of America goes bankrupt because of their debt. One of them's got to go. We can't continue to do this. So we add another I think this $2 trillion for infrastructure, which is a joke calling it infrastructure, but nonetheless, the $2 trillion for infrastructure isn't it. It is just a continuation of the debt that the far left, the administration, is going to continue to keep us on. And it's nothing that $20 trillion is going to look like nothing in national debt compared to what it's going to look like 3 years from now. So,
especially if we have to pay for that debt with much higher interest rates. And that's what's in prospect if you say inflation is afoot.
That's why the scam of we say, well, interest rates aren't going to go up. Why? Because they can't go up. The Treasury Secretary Yellen, another globalist, who is talking to the Federal Reserve, is saying no matter what happens, we can't raise interest rates. If we get anywhere near normalized interest rates, which I'm going to say today is probably 3.5 to 4%, we get anywhere near that, that's going to add well over $1 trillion of debt to our debt because of the servicing of the debt.
Which we don't have the money to pay for if we're going to pay for anything else like our national security. Dan, this is such an important topic, and we're so grateful to you for what you do at Financial Issues to illuminate these things day in and day out, and for your visits with us each week. Thank you for doing that. Come back, please. I'm hoping with better news, but I'm afraid your forecasts are all too clear-eyed and just what we need to know, because we're in a world of hurt. That's for sure. God bless you, my friend. We'll talk with you again next week.
You're welcome. It's great to be here. I appreciate it. Keep up the fight.
Thank you. We appreciate it. Talking to somebody else right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and it's always a pleasure to say we're joined by Colonel Grant Newsom, U.S. Marine Corps retired, a man who has also served his country as a member of the Foreign Service and has worked extensively in East Asia in international business as well. These days, he is a research fellow at the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies and also, I'm pleased to say, a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy. Grant, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Well, thanks very much. Glad to be here.
We were treated last week to an important piece by you in Asia Times entitled, "Is China Willing and Able to Invade Taiwan?" And you make a pretty convincing case, it seems to me, that it is. And I'd like you to lay that out for our audience in brief form, if you would.
Sure. What I was writing in the piece is that the China does, in fact, have the military capability to launch an all-out assault on Taiwan. They could probably do it with very short notice and possibly without the U.S. side getting any advance notice of preparations. My position is contrary to what a number of observers and analysts think, but it is based on my assessment over a number of years and simply doing the math of what China has available and also their capabilities. And once I lay that out, I then suggest that China would indeed have some real motivation for rolling the dice in effect and taking their chances, given the immense strategic value that would come of seizing Taiwan. By doing that, China would in fact get a foothold right in the middle of America's first initial defenses, so the so-called first island chain. From there, they can easily have improved access further into the Pacific. But even more importantly, it would destroy any confidence anybody in Asia, and some would say elsewhere, in U.S. security guarantees, whether specific or implicit. So that's what I was writing up. And you know, that's how I called it as I saw it.
I must say that there seem to be more and more people, including some senior U.S. commanders, who are arriving at similar conclusions. And I gather, Grant, that some of this is based on war games that have been conducted, where I guess some of those same numbers that you've been crunching have been played out and proved to be rather, well, shall we say, unsatisfactory from the U.S. point of view. When you talk about the quantities and the qualitative capabilities of the Chinese, I think what's so impressive to me is the ability to do this kind of formidable undertaking. Some have compared it to a D-Day style invasion, more or less from a standing start, if not actually, certainly with very little warning because of the high degree of readiness and the forward deployments and the preparations that have clearly been made to move very quickly in this regard. Talk us through that, if you would, and its implications.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, some background. The outgoing Indo-PACOM commander suggested just a few weeks ago that China could attack Taiwan within 6 years, so by 2027. And that moved the timeline up for a lot of people. And the incoming PACOM commander, in his testimony to the Senate, he said it could be even faster than that. So, and they have access to all the intelligence, all the good analysis, and that's what they're saying. The information and evidence was, in fact, available 10 years ago, but commanders in the Pacific chose not to believe it. But that's neither here nor there at the moment. But China does have the ships, the aircraft, the troops who are trained in amphibious operations, and to launch a successful attack across the Taiwan Strait. And they also have excellent cyber capabilities, thousands of long-range missiles. They've had 50 years to find their targets. They have good satellite coverage, outer space capabilities. If you go down the list of what's required, they've pretty much got it all. And there's a sense in some quarters on the U.S. that, well, the Chinese just aren't smart enough to do this. That's condescending, and it's wrong, in my opinion. So it's dangerous. Well,
as you point out in your piece,
worse than that.
Yeah, you underestimate them at your peril. Some have said, look, they just don't have experience with, you know, military operations of this kind, or even combat operations to speak of, for decades now. How do you factor that into your calculations, Grant Newsom, as an experienced military man yourself?
You hear that excuse a lot. It's a way to downplay Chinese capabilities, in some respects to make us feel better about ourselves. But training will make up for a lack of combat capability. It generally takes a few weeks, really, just to get up to speed once the shooting starts. But good, hard training will do the job. Keep in mind that in every war the Americans have started, gotten involved in, the last few decades, the U.S. forces have had almost no combat capability. That goes for Iraq, Afghanistan, etc. But say good training will make up for it. And do keep in mind, the U.S. Navy hasn't fought a real enemy for goodness, probably since World War II. So they aren't exactly rolling in experience for this sort of high-end warfare.
With a peer competitor, as they say. Yeah. And Grant, training as you intend to fight is also an important ingredient in all of this. And have you seen, you mentioned troops that have been trained, Marines and so on, in amphibious operations. Have you seen them training in a way that suggests that this kind of, D-Day operation, for want of a better term, is indeed the intent of the Chinese Communist Party?
Oh, yeah. They've been training literally for decades with one mission, and that is Taiwan. It's been on the menu for, goodness, 60, 70 years almost, and this is what they practice. Of course, like any military anywhere, they have their own degree of being screwed up, for want of a better word. This stuff isn't easy. And when that's why the Americans train, is because they have to sort of improve and figure out their mistakes and try not to make too many of them if push comes to shove. So that is something similar with the Chinese. It's not as if they're perfect and don't make mistakes or have problems, but they nonetheless have built up a considerable capability that you ignore at your peril.
And sadly, what they're looking at in terms of opposing forces are generally, I think, considered to be wholly inadequate dealing with the kind of capability that the Chinese could bring to bear. And I did want to ask you specifically about something that you've written about, which is the ability the Chinese would have to sort of pivot from an exercise into an operation, using it to sort of get the jump on both the defenders in Taiwan and perhaps the U.S. Navy, such as it is out there these days. Talk about that in the context, if you would, of the carrier battle group that the Chinese are now operating in Taiwanese littoral waters, and whether this could, again, serve as, if not the incident that begins the next conflict, certainly the kind of desensitization that the Chinese may be seeking with these sorts of exercises.
Oh, yes, that's one of the concerns, is that as China continues to do more and more complex training exercises and in more places around Taiwan, that people just so get so used to and desensitized to what the Chinese are doing that they just think, oh, it's just another exercise. But over time, that China does do more of these exercises and it's more complex on a bigger scale, that there's no reason why they couldn't just use one of them for an actual assault, especially if the method they're going to use is what we call a decapitation strike or a coup de main, a very quick surprise attack to seize some key airfields, ports, and kill Taiwan's leadership, and then start your assault with a sort of a fairly small number of forces and resources, grab a foothold, and then push in a lot more stuff quickly. That's a real possibility.
And you mentioned the possibility, in addition to that, that they would have fifth column elements inside Taiwan already poised to assist in that regard. Grant, let me ask you one final question, because it's come up particularly in our conversations with one of our other colleagues, J.R. Nyquist, that the Chinese may have taken away from Hitler's experience in World War II the conclusion that it's best, if you're going to do something like this, to take down the main enemy, not just the immediate target, rather than leave that main enemy at liberty to become more formidable and ultimately perhaps decisively to defeat you. Would you anticipate, as part of all of this, that we may find ourselves under attack as well, either locally or more generally?
Mm-hmm. Well, you have to consider that a possibility. The Chinese do their homework, and they've studied history, maybe not entirely correctly, but they do study it and draw their conclusions. And you could see them. There's any number of options. One could be an assault, say a missile assault on one of our allies, one of our friends in the region, say Japan. They could, for example. Or you could get the Chinese to have the North Koreans do something up on the Korean Peninsula, which is a distraction. At the same time, the Russians just have to rattle some sabers and or maybe even make a small move into some territory they want.
Or not so small, over the Ukraine at the moment. You know, all of these things
seem
impossible.
The Iranians, the Iranians too cause a distraction. So that you really have to consider a lot of possibilities. And when people think of Taiwan, very often people just choose whatever scenario they're most comfortable with or that comes to mind most easily. But you really do have to consider sort of the full playbook of the Chinese.
Or a lot of times we seem to just be whistling past the graveyard, hoping that none of this will eventually, altogether too long.
Years,
Grant Newsom, thank you for your time today and for these clear warnings of what may be in the offing. And it is the sort of thing that I hope is getting the concentrated attention of the Biden-Harris team. And we expect nothing less, but require, must have nothing less, that's for sure. Thank you, Grant. We'll talk with you again very soon. Next up, we will speak with David Wormser about Iran, that problem in the Middle East that Grant has just alluded to, and more right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back, and welcome once more to a friend and colleague at the Center for Security Policy, Dr. David Wormser. He is these days a senior fellow and director of its project on global anti-Semitism and the U.S.-Israel relationship. He has extensive experience in national security policymaking in the United States government, notably as the Middle East expert for then Vice President Dick Cheney. He is a retired lieutenant commander in the United States Navy Reserve, specializing in intelligence, and we're always delighted to bring his intelligence to bear on topics specifically in his area of great expertise, the Middle East. David, welcome back. It's good to have you.
Well, thanks to have me on. It's great.
So there is much to talk about in your portfolio. We were just visiting with Grant Newsom, and he alluded to the possibility that I feel is very much real, that things could go sideways big time, both in his area of expertise, the Far East, and also in yours, specifically as a result of what the Iranians are up to. Before we turn to that directly, let me just ask you for a little bit of context. You've recently written a piece for the Foundation for American Security and Freedom that talks about the recent elections in Israel and where things stand at the moment. Talk about that, David, if you would, both with respect to what it means for the Israelis themselves, but also as a sort of prelude to what might mean for the region.
Well, I think that there's a couple trends in the Israeli elections that are significant. One is that the current prime minister, Netanyahu, is currently still unable to cleanly form a government. And in this round, he may not even be able to form a government. There may be another round of elections. One thing this means is that the Israeli government is not quite fully functional. I wouldn't underestimate how much they're capable of operating, even under these circumstances, and dealing with major regional issues. And I think the attack that Israel launched on one of the Iranian ships in the Red Sea yesterday is indicative of that. But still, it's not a fully functioning government. So this government crisis.
Is there any question that that was an Israeli attack?
No, at this point not, because the Israelis have admitted it, essentially.
This is turnabout fair play for an attack on Israeli tanker or a cargo vessel recently, would you say?
Yes, what it is, it's an Israeli response to a whole series of Iranian attacks on Israeli interests worldwide. So it's partly a tit for tat, but also this ship was essentially a floating base for the IRGC operating.
The Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps.
That's right. It was an Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps ship, exactly. And my sense is this is a result also of some Saudi-Israeli cooperation. This was essentially a strategic military base, not a ship. So it is partly retaliation, but I think it's also partly a strategic move. So the Israeli government can function, but still it is somewhat hampered by the fact that there's no government. Now, another trend in the Israeli election worth watching is, despite the fact that the current prime minister, who leads a right-leaning bloc in the Israeli political system, despite the fact that he couldn't form a government cleanly and easily, the parliament as a whole has shifted very much to the right. There are between 75 to 80 seats out of 120 in the parliament of people who can be considered right wing. So,
but just not all supporters of Benjamin Netanyahu.
It has more to do with the personal fights between Netanyahu and some other leaders on the right than it does with the country moving to the left. The country's not moving to the left. It's actually moving to the right. And that has implications in the long term, too.
Now, David, does all that mean that the writing is on the wall, namely that Benjamin Netanyahu's days are numbered? He's now, of course, being prosecuted in a criminal trial for corruption allegations. He is also, as you say, divisive. There are people who are otherwise aligned but not willing to work with him. Should we expect another election for him to be the standard bearer for the right?
Well, I think that's a good question. I think we should expect a fifth round of elections in 2 years. Whether he'll be the standard bearer, that's a big question. This last election round theoretically should have been his best, because he's coming off of a very successful effort to vaccinate the entire country. Israel has essentially reopened already, and it's reaching herd immunity as we speak. So COVID is in the rearview mirror for that country. It also had the Abraham Accords, a peace treaty with more nations. In the last half year of the Trump administration, there were more peace treaties between Israel and Arabs than in the entire history of the state of Israel. So at this point, he had a lot going for him, and he still couldn't pull it off. And now there's a growing perception on the right in Israel that he can't pull it off. So that works against him. So I'm wondering, I think there will be a fifth round of elections, but I think there's a possibility he may leave the scene on his own volition, on a high note.
But if there were elections, it would not take place for another 2 years? That seems unlikely to me.
No, if there were another election, he he has about 6 to 8 weeks to form a new government, at which point the parliament itself can vote to form a new government on its own without anybody being tasked to do so. It won't be able to do that. It will be unable to do that. So we're talking somewhere around the end of May. The parliament will have to vote to set a new election date, which will be within a few months. So we're looking at another Israeli election by the end of the summer.
But the possibility that he will not be the incumbent and the candidate of the largest party on the right. Let's pivot, if we can, David, quickly to whether this country that is clearly engaged in warfare against Israel and considered by Israel to be its greatest enemy and that of other nations in the region as well, namely Iran, is feeling that all of this gives rise to an opportunity to act more aggressively, not least to intensify its efforts to acquire nuclear weapons. If you could briefly talk about what the Iranians are up to, and specifically mention, at least in passing, what seems to be in a pretty direct affront to the United States, saying that we're not going to talk to them in Vienna.
Yes. What's happening is that the Iranians are becoming more aggressive daily, at the same time that the United States is abandoning the Saudis daily. I think the juxtaposition of withdrawing Patriot missiles from Saudi Arabia at the same time that these drone attacks are becoming nearly daily by Houthis, which are essentially Iranian agents, against Saudi Arabia. This encourages the Iranians. The releasing of money to Iranian coffers, which is already underway from some foreign countries, clearly wouldn't have done it without American a green light. This is disturbing. It funds Iran. The Iranian people are feeling abandoned, especially with all this talk of lifting sanctions. There were actually demonstrations in Iran against the lifting of sanctions against Iran by Iranian people. They want their government under pressure. So Iran feels strong, and it feels it's on a rise, and it's essentially now acting that way.
And is that likely to translate, David Wormser, in your professional judgment, into a greater threat of conflict?
The historical record with Iran is that whenever it feels emboldened or strengthened, it becomes far more dangerous, aggressive, and bellicose. And I think we're seeing that right now. So I think the Iranian government, both for the long term, since it still has these internal problems, because of its ideology and because its sense of American weakness, is becoming very aggressive and very dangerous.
I fear this is the case as well, and that unfortunately it's just one of the dangerous hotspots in the world at the moment that may well be in part becoming, flashpoints for conflict as a result, at least in part, due to the weakness of the U.S. administration, perceived or real. David Wormser, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you for your time today and the great work you do at the Center for Security Policy. We'll look forward to talking with you again next week. In the meantime, Godspeed. And we'll look forward to talking to the rest of you again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.